Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest today is Olga Oliker, Program Director for Europe and Central Asia at the Crisis Group. Thank you very much for joining me, Dr. Oliker.
Thank you for having me back.
All right. It's great to have you on the podcast again. Now, Russia's war in Ukraine has been going on for more than 8 years since Moscow seized control of Crimea and fomented separatism in eastern and southern Ukraine, leading to armed conflict in the region known as the Donbass, Donetsk and Luhansk regions of Ukraine. But yesterday, July 24th, marked 5 months since Russia launched a large-scale invasion of Ukraine early on the morning of February 24th. So this phase of the war is now in its 6th month. President Vladimir Putin and other Russian officials have spoken of various war goals, some involving territory and some more political. But frequently, at least until recently, one of the main goals they've spoken of involves controlling the Donbass in full. And the language that they've used for this also has varied, and often they've framed the objective as stopping what they absolutely falsely claim is genocide by Ukraine in the Donbass. This is a false claim. But regardless of the wording, in practice, the aim in terms of this particular goal is to control the Donbass. And that objective has been in place since the day of the invasion or before. Whatever other aims have been announced or have been clear from Russia's actions, for example, the unsuccessful effort to take Kyiv, the capital, in the days and weeks immediately after the invasion began on February 24th. But there's been a change in the past week, at least in the wording that Russia is using. In comments on July 20th, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said that, quote, geography had changed and that Moscow's objectives now include the Kherson and Zaporizhia regions southwest of the Donbass. They kind of link the Donbass and the Russian border to Crimea, as well as, quote, a number of other territories that Lavrov did not name. And he also said that Moscow's territorial goals in Ukraine would expand if the West were to provide Kyiv with long-range weapons, which it has not done to date. Now, to some degree, Lavrov was stating the obvious, or even the very obvious. Russian forces have already taken control of parts of both the Zaporizhia and Kherson regions, including the city of Kherson, though they are facing serious counterattacks. And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has spoken confidently of the prospect of Ukrainian forces taking those areas back. Now, another development in recent days related to the war was the signing of a deal to allow Ukrainian grain exports that had been stymied by Russia's blockage of Black Sea ports. And that deal was praised as an effort and, you know, something that could alleviate the world hunger problem, which has been exacerbated by this Russian blockade. But it was very quickly cast in doubt when Russia fired missiles that hit port facilities in Odessa. Now, Ukraine has spoken of going ahead with the deal and efforts to export grain, and Russia's claiming that its strikes shouldn't affect grain exports, but price of wheat has gone up following the attacks, and there's obviously serious doubt about, you know, the viability of this agreement given the strikes on Odessa. Olga, what do you make of these developments? Do they say anything about the course of the war in the short or medium term, and also the prospects for any other agreements?
Thank you. So I think it is actually really important to differentiate between political goals and territorial goals, military goals, right? The military goals, which are the goals of how much territory you're going to take, which you're going to accomplish, are meant in service of political goals. But the political goals haven't actually changed, right? Russia's political goal, the reason it's fighting this war, is because it wants a Ukraine that's subordinate to Russia, a West that accepts that, and more broadly, a division in Eurasia that accepts Russian influence and control over not just Ukraine, but other former Soviet countries, short of the Baltics, but possibly most, if not all, of the rest. The military goals of the war fighting, those have shifted for Russia. Russian plans at first seemed to be this very large-scale invasion, the shock and awe of which and Ukrainian welcome, in the face of which was going to lead to Ukrainian government collapse, and then everybody recognizing that status quo, and then Russia would have accomplished its goal. That obviously did not happen. So it suggested its military aims, but not its political aims. So you've got this military fight that's still fundamentally coercive, right? However much territory they get, their fundamental goal is to get Ukraine under Russian control. I think when we're listening to this conversation about the Donbas and about Kherson and Zaporizhia, it's really important to note that when there have been negotiations, and there have been conversations, and also the kind of negotiating that's done in the public sphere through statements and comments by officials, the Russian negotiators aren't saying we'll stop where we are, right? They're not saying we can freeze this conflict where it is. They're saying give us more territory than we currently control, accept the additional losses of that territory, and we'll think about stopping rather than doing the damage that would be done by taking it by force. Now, Ukraine, for its part, says that Russia needs to leave all of Ukraine, which presumably includes territory that Russia has held since 2014, and not just the territory gained since February 24th. So the negotiations haven't been serious there, because both parties' positions are you make the concessions, we will not make any concessions. And the reason is that they both think that they could still win. But I think the point that Russia has said, that Lavrov said, that Russia's territorial aims will expand if the West supplies weapons is really interesting. Because, in fact, Russia's territorial aims will probably expand if Russia gains more territory and thinks that it can keep going. That's kind of how it's worked up until now. But the message they're sending by saying that is that Russia's planning to punish Ukraine, not the West, for weapons flows. Now, of course, the reality is that if these weapons are effective and Ukraine is actually able to launch a real counteroffensive, I mean, it's gained back a little bit of territory, but it's been very slow. But if it's actually able to undertake a real counteroffensive, Russia's going to have a lot less capacity to take territory. So, there's a little bit of irony there, and also a little bit of just PR. On the grain deal and the strike on Odessa, I mean, there's no knowing for certain exactly what the logic was of that strike. It's possible that it was planned in advance and never called off. It's possible that it was always meant as a coercive measure to remind Ukraine and the world that Russia can still mess with them. Either way, even if it's the former, Russia's going to be trying to use it as the latter, right? Now that something is done, you leverage it for whatever gain you can leverage it for. Now, my guess is the deal will go forward, as the Ukrainians and the Russians say it will, but also that we're going to see more derailments and more harassment, and especially from Russia, an effort to kind of keep people on their toes. We'll see what that does to food supplies and prices. I mean, to some extent, you've already seen a lot of workarounds put in place to get food to people. There'll be more of that, and I think that's, one of the issues is just how dependent markets want to be on these particular supplies going forward.
Thank you. And I guess just to sort of ask a follow-up question on the grain issue, this, I think the second kind of reason, potential reason for the strikes on Odessa, you indicated was an effort to, keep, I guess, Ukraine and the West on their toes and to say, so is it sort of a way to say, okay, we're going ahead with this, because we want to. I mean, the PR element in it partially is, we want to help feed the world, but that doesn't mean we're giving up on any this isn't a defeat for us, and it doesn't mean we're giving up on any of our goals in Ukraine. Would that be an accurate description?
Perhaps. I mean, the other interesting thing here, though, is that before the Russians struck Odessa, one possible hypothesis was that Ukraine would now be nervous about continuing the conflict just in case, or continuing strikes on the Russian ammunition storage sites that they've been striking and so forth, because they wouldn't want to derail the deal. Well, now the Russians have used force and derailed the deal, which sort of takes any limitations off the Ukrainians in this perspective, right? So, you know, potentially the Russians have actually taken away a point of leverage from themselves by doing this, even if what they were seeking was a point of leverage.
That's interesting. So that's sort of maybe an argument in favor of your first kind of hypothesis, that it may have been planned in advance and then just not, you know, somebody didn't get the message to not carry it out. So essentially a kind of a mistake.
Or it's just a dumb move, right? I mean, it can also be intended as a coercive action, but that can backfire, right? The capacity of people to make bad decisions should not be underestimated.
Right. As we've seen throughout this conflict since the invasion, I guess. And just on the other issue, the Lavrov statement. So I guess, in a way, it's kind of putting out a marker for any talks to say, you know, maybe we've given the impression that we might be satisfied with the Donbass and Crimea, of course. But now, you know, if there are going to be any talks, it's going to at least have to include Kherson and Zaporizhia and also, you know, whatever other territories we might say that we want or be able to take. Is that right, I think?
So I think, right, the idea is you go to negotiate because you feel that you are in some way at a disadvantage, or you go to negotiate because you think you're at an advantage and you're going to get concessions out of your adversary. The Russians are saying they're in the second category. And I think, and their point all along has been that we'll negotiate to get more than we're currently holding, not to get what we're currently holding or less, right? We'll go to the negotiating table to accomplish what we can't, you know, basically we'll go to the negotiating table to save us time, energy, and lives on the battlefield, but with still the same aims. Now, you know, if they do end up on the back foot, then that could shift. If the Ukrainians end up on the back foot, it shifts in the other direction. And this is why watching how the fighting goes is going to be, that's where the decisive, that's what's going to be decisive in coming weeks, months, however long it ends up taking. Kind of what they say is going to be a reflection of how they understand the battlefield, and what they actually are willing to negotiate will be that as well.
Right. So, you know, in the end, the words aren't going to matter that much because they'll have to be adjusted to the situation, I guess. All right. Well, thanks very much for that. The other question I'd like to ask, it's related, especially since we're talking about, you know, who's getting the upper hand or who might do so in the future. But I'd like to ask about the situation inside Russia, which I think goes under the radar sometimes, understandably, given what's happening in Ukraine, the death and suffering and destruction that Russia continues to wreak there. RFURL has been reporting recently about some Russian soldiers who've refused to go to war or have refused to fight or go to the front once inside Ukraine. And in Russia itself, the economic effects of the war and sanctions are hitting Russians in both an immediate and a gradual way. I mean, there's talk about, they're hitting gradually and things will be worse later in the year. So I guess my question is, do you see any real changes inside Russia as the war enters its 6 month? In terms of attitudes towards the war or attitudes towards the situation that people find themselves in.
So I want to caveat this by saying I'm not in Russia, I'm in Brussels. And, you know, what I get from Russia is obviously secondhand information. I also think that particularly when your information is secondhand, one tends to exaggerate the stories that confirm one's biases and ignore the ones that challenge those biases. So I try to be very, very careful with information. I always ask myself, you know, am I hearing what I want to hear? Am I hearing what I expect to hear? What do I really think any of this means? And I think my bottom line from kind of trying to just look at the evidence and parse it is that Russia's clearly having trouble getting trained people, trained men really, because it has very few women in its armed forces, but it's having a hard time getting these trained, capable men into the fight. Now, economic hardship could actually help with that, particularly in the poor parts of the country that have been supplying the soldiers for this war. Those folks have even fewer choices for how to make money. Then letting their men, sending their men to serve becomes a better and better idea. In wealthier parts of the country, where people are less likely to find themselves on the front lines, they're dealing with higher prices. They're doing a lot of belt tightening, which arguably they've been doing since 2014 to varying degrees. I mean, it's an interesting phenomenon, right? We have certainly seen Russians protest because of economic issues in the past, but they protest the very specific economic issues, right? They don't say the underlying policy is bad. They don't say you need to reform the economy. They say don't raise our pension age. So I think, you know, the odds of Russians rising up against this war in any real way are super low. And even if that very super low probability comes to pass, the other thing I think to keep in mind is we probably won't see it coming. If we can see it coming, the Kremlin can see it coming, and they're going to do whatever they can to prevent it coming. So, you know, if I'm looking at what I think Russia is going to do, I think Russia is going to be able to maintain sufficient support or at least complacence about the war that won't present a real problem for them. I mean, kind of my smart money would be on the Kremlin sustaining the support, not somehow falling apart because Russians turn against them. I just think that's a super low probability event.
Thanks for that. Good points about, you know, not being in Russia, and also I'm struck by the idea that we won't see it coming. And I think you're absolutely right about that, just based on kind of the past and the developments that have happened in the Soviet Union and Russia over the past, you know, decades. Which in many cases, many people did not see them coming. So, you know, that's a caveat, but also, you know, your points about the situation seem quite solid. I'm going to stop there and open it up for questions. Thanks very much, Olga. Does anyone have any questions?
Hi, Richard, you can speak.
Yes, thank you for this presentation. And Professor, I just wondered if you could tell us, if Ukraine was given sufficient material resources, are they capable of winning, defined as retaking the territories that they have currently lost? And is there a difference between taking just the territories minus Crimea, or would they be able to take Crimea too? And what are the chances of this happening? Thank you.
So the short, easy answer is nobody knows the answer to that question. I mean, I think that this is, and there are a number of challenges in all of this. And I say this as somebody who, you know, there's with a certain amount of humility, right? Back in February, I was pretty confident that there was no amount of military aid you could give Ukraine that would enable them to push back the Russians. So it turned out that the Ukrainians could push back the Russians. So that had as much to do with the Russians having attacked with a bad plan and with a military that was not as capable, or at least not as capable of the things they were telling it to do, as they expected it to be. So, you know, there are a lot of factors that go into what one can and cannot do. So there are a couple of issues with getting weapons into Ukraine. One of them is simple absorption, right? You have to physically get the weapons to Ukraine, and then you have to make sure that people are trained on the weapons, and then the weapons have to get to the battlefield. This is a process, and it all takes time. And I think this is one of the challenges that we've seen over the last months, this frustration of why aren't the weapons there? Why does it take so long? Well, it takes so long because this isn't a teleporter that instantaneously gets everything there. And particularly once we moved from basically sending them rounds and Soviet-era or Soviet-type equipment to Western-style equipment, it required a lot more training. We have not seen the Ukrainians mount significant counteroffensives. The territory that Ukraine has been able to retake it in large, substantial quantities, it has retaken because the Russians withdrew, not because they fought it free. So, you know, this is one of the open questions. We've seen Ukraine use the HIMARS provided by the United States, especially to very effectively disrupt Russian supply lines by going after ammunition storage sites and so forth and forcing them to disperse. That's effective. It's not a counteroffensive. Now, possibly we don't have a counteroffensive because they have enough weapons, and this is kind of the Ukrainian line on this. They have enough weapons to do the to do the supply line disruption, but not enough to mount the counteroffensive. I don't know. And kind of this question of how much will it take, what will it take, I don't know. It's really hard to judge this when we haven't seen them operate that way. And then once we see it, then we can judge. Crimea is a really different issue, right? The Black Sea Fleet, the Russian Black Sea Fleet is based out of there. It's fundamentally, in many ways, a Russian garrison town. So it's completely different challenge. And even moreover, if you look at the parts of Ukraine that Russia has controlled for a long time, and even, you know, you're looking at the parts of Ukraine that Russia has taken control of recently, they're building fortifications. And the parts of Ukraine that Russia has controlled longer, they've had more time to build fortifications. One of the reasons Russia has moved so slowly into Ukraine over the last 5 months is because Ukraine, particularly in the east, has built fortifications because this is much more the fight they expected. So, you know, this isn't going to be an easy, it's just a question of getting them better gear, and they should be able to plow on through. It's really something that it's a big unknown. And I think it's one of the reasons that the Ukrainians would certainly much rather disrupt supply lines, make it really hard for the Russians to put forces into the fight, and hope that the personnel challenges and equipment challenges overwhelm them and they don't have to try to actually counterattack and win back territory which Russia has had time to fortify.
Thanks. Can I just actually, I guess, add a question or follow up on that? And the question is, in addition, in terms of Crimea, but also maybe the parts of the Donbass that Russia and the separatists held before February 24th, that includes the cities of Donetsk and Luhansk, you know, is there kind of separate from the military question of, you know, what would it take for Ukraine to take these territories back? Is there a point where support in the West, you know, fades when it comes to, okay, we want to take Crimea, you know, or even, you know, we want to take take all of the Donbass back? I mean, I've just sort of laymen whom I've spoken to have, I would say, been of the opinion that there should be peace, and you know, Russia can keep some territory. So I'm just relaying that idea that I think some people have, who aren't really, you know, who may not even be paying much attention to the war beyond how it might affect them. But so that's my question: is there sort of a point where support in the West kind of balks, you know, at what Ukraine might want?
I mean, possibly. Wow, sorting that out would be a good problem to have, right? We're nowhere near this dilemma of, you know, do you cut a deal or does Ukraine try to retake Crimea? Ukraine needs to be able to retake Kherson first. I think the question of whether that is, you know, I think retaking Crimea would be really, really difficult. I think should such an offensive take place and be successful, governing Crimea after would be really difficult. I have very strong doubts Ukraine has any particular plans for how you do any of that. So I think this is all super duper hypothetical. I do think this question of just how long Western support for continuing to pour weapons into Ukraine lasts is an important one. One challenge is simply just having the supplies of the weapons. This is a super intensive war, which is just sucking up ammunition, sucking up artillery. So you're already seeing Western countries getting a little bit worried. They ran out of their Soviet-style stuff in the storehouses really pretty fast. You know, European countries especially, they don't actually maintain such vast arsenals that they can just keep pouring stuff into Ukraine without... you know, without having to replenish and think about how to replenish. And I think this might be one of the arguments, in fact, behind this huge flow that we've seen and all the promises that we've seen is the idea that if you can give them enough that they can at least take the momentum, maybe this war ends sooner and you don't have to keep doing this for a very, very long period of time where it is European and American taxpayers that are paying for more and more and more and more weapons over time. We've also, you know, there's also this question of how effectively Ukraine uses the weapons, whether everything that's getting to Ukraine, how long it takes it to get to the soldiers on the front lines, whether anybody is trying to make a hryvnia on this. I think those are all really good questions. And the more awash Ukraine is in weapons, the more people are going to be concerned about them. But yeah, I mean, kind of the catastrophic victory scenario problem. Let's cross that bridge when we get to it. It's not even in sight now.
Yes, fair enough. Thanks. That's a very good answer. And I guess, you know, as we were saying about kind of the situation in the nearer future, attitudes and kind of red lines might shift, you know, depending on what happens, what territorial gains, you know, are made by either side in the future. So what once seemed off limits might become, you know, not off limits in the future, I guess. So just want to throw it out to any other questions. If anyone has any, please let us know. Just give it a few more moments here.
Hi, Wahid, you can speak.
Wahid?
Hi, dear friends. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Welcome.
Hi, you have a question?
My location.
Okay.
Hi, Matthew, you can speak.
Hey there. I think that my request for a question has been submitted. I wanted to ask about this deal between Russia, Ukraine, Turkey, and the UN regarding grain exports. And given we already discussed the attack, but that Russia made on Odessa in the immediate aftermath of that deal. But I was hoping to get your estimate on whether the export of those, I believe, 20 million metric tons of grain sitting on Ukrainian ports would have an impact on people who might be starving or near starvation around the rest of the world. I was hoping to get your assessment of the effectiveness of the deal.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. I mean, really good question. And I think there are a couple of things at work here. One is simply getting the stuff onto the market will lower prices. And, you know, the announcement of the deal lowered prices somewhat in expectation, then the strike raised them again. But, you know, this will make grain more affordable and it will lower food prices overall. And that'll make, you know, kind of even before this particular grain gets to anybody at all, it'll potentially make people stockpile less and just get other grain into households. Then beyond that, there's the question of making grain available to humanitarian actors like the World Food Program, which, of course, grows no grain of its own, right? So it's completely dependent on supplies from elsewhere. So making sure that it can distribute grain. Now, in the 5 months of this war, a number of workarounds for getting food to people have already been found. So some of the crisis has been partially alleviated already. But kind of as the grain starts to move, it just creates access for more people and it relieves pressure, as well as over time specifically feeding people. So you need to look at this from the standpoint of a larger market rather than kind of very specifically this container ship is going to get to Lebanon, right? It's more the broader question of how it affects the supplies of grain and prices. And then, of course, there's also the question of whether Russia does, which has been refusing to sell fertilizer and its own grain, and which has been hampered in it, when it does try to sell these things by the fact that shipping companies can't get insurance, not because they're sanctioned, but because of concerns they may be sanctioned in the future. So there's some question about whether that comes into the market and also takes off some of the pressure. Of course, if we do have continued fighting, if missiles keep flying, then the ships that are coming from Ukraine might also have some trouble getting insured. So, all of these factors are going to play in to exactly how well this works. But overall, if the grain is moving, it should alleviate pressure. If the grain is not moving, then the pressure is up again.
Okay, thanks for that. I think we have time for one more question if there is another question out there. So I will give it a few moments again. And if not, we can wrap it up here. It's been very, very...
Sorry. Nirvan, you can ask your question. Nirvan, you can speak.
Hi, thank you so much. I wonder what's your reflection on the position of Hungary in this world. Orban have made a lot of statements, have met Lavrov, have asked for changing the European position toward the war. Can Hungary divide Europe? Can Hungary capitalize on the vulnerability of Europe, all what you raised before? Or do you think Hungary will be isolated and Europe will remain united in supporting Ukraine? Thank you.
I mean, one interesting thing, and thank you for that question. I think one interesting thing to date has been that Hungary makes a lot of noise, but right over 8 years of war and sanctions, it has actually then gone and gone along with the sanctions regime. So it makes a lot of noise. It tries to pull, it tries to push things in a different direction, but it generally, in the end, fails to do that. If it wants to peel off, I mean, as you say, it can separate itself from Europe. There, you know, European politicians are absolutely very concerned about the capacity to sustain support of Ukraine, including the sanctions and including the weapons provisions in the face of high energy prices, and expect this to become worse with the onset of winter, when we all tend to use more energy here in Europe. They're also, of course, very concerned about elections and the ability to stay in power to maintain these policies too, right? Even if people want to support Ukraine, they may not connect this, and they may vote people out of power if they think that they don't like their policies because prices are rising. And then the people who come in may not be as supportive of Ukraine, et cetera. Having said, so I think these are real concerns, and because they're real concerns, politicians talk about them. In some ways, I think these conversations actually create an impression of more division in Europe than there is. Right, the fact that there are these debates, that people ask the questions and they do so openly, it can create this sense that, oh, wow, they're not that sure. But if you actually talk to European politicians, they're pretty committed. And, you know, I think it would take a lot for them to walk back from that commitment. They stayed committed through the 8 years of the war from 2014 to 2022. They were very committed when they decided to impose the sanctions that they've put in place. There's been a bit of an escalation of commitment, right, in the last 5 months. So we'll see how this actually shakes out. And it may be that some countries will be less likely to stay on board than others. But overall, I would say that my money is on Europe sticking together. I think that the general perception among European policymakers is this isn't just about Ukraine. This is about European security longer term, and they're willing to take some hits for it. So, you know, this could all fall apart if governments do start falling. But I think the way things look now, I would put my money on unity.
Great, thank you.
All right, and I wonder whether the kind of the open discussion and I guess concern and worrying about the problem of unity may color Putin's views and sort of make him overestimate the prospect of unity falling apart in the West. So that'd be an interesting question. I think we're running out of time. I really want to thank Dr. Olwicker. Detailed grasp of a broad range of issues and I think excellent answers. So Dr. Olwicker, thanks very much for your time and your insights.
No, thank you for having me, and big thanks to everybody for joining in and for asking really good questions. So it's a really interesting conversation for me as well.
All right, thanks again. And again, I've been speaking to Olga Olwicker, Program Director for Europe and Central Asia at the Crisis Group. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. As I mentioned at the start, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'll be back next Monday for another edition of The Week in Russia, and please keep an eye out for my newsletter, The Week in Russia, on Friday. Thanks for listening.